Building a Path to Neptune, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. The Planetary Science and Astrobiology Decadal Survey recommendations for the next 10 years of exploration will be released on April 19th. An enormous amount of work will have gone into this report, including the preparation of an ambitious concept study titled Neptune Odyssey, a mission to the Neptune-Triton system. Though it may sound like one, it's not a mission proposal. Project engineer Brenda Clyde and project scientist Kirby Runyon will join me in moments to explain and to help us understand why they and their international team hope the Decadal will prioritize a trip like the one they describe. We'll also check on the night sky with Bruce Betts. The chief scientist has some cool random space facts to share, along with another great prize for the new space trivia contest. Does that Pluto image that tops the April 1 edition of the Downlink look a little duller than some? It's not an April Fool's joke, it's Pluto, without the false color enhancements that reveal more about this world. I don't think it's any less spectacular. You'll find it at planetary.org/downlink, along with these headlines. The Hubble Space Telescope has detected the light of a star, a single star, that radiated outward more than 13 billion years ago. That makes it the farthest and oldest individual star ever seen. Don't count out the European Space Agency's ExoMars mission just yet. ESA says it will consider other partners after it lost its ride on a Russian booster. The Rosalind Franklin rover will go into safe storage at a corporate site in Italy while the search continues. We heard a quick overview of NASA's new budget request last week when Casey Dreyer stopped by. Casey, Brendan, Curry, and I will go much deeper in the April Space Policy edition of Planetary Radio. Watch for it in your podcast feed on Friday, April 8th. Brenda Clyde and Kirby Runyon have a lot in common. They both work for the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, where both contributed to the New Horizons mission and many other projects. Brenda is part of the principal professional staff at APL, while Kirby is a senior research scientist. If you stay till the end of my conversation with them, you'll learn that Kirby also has had a long, long relationship with a certain podcast and public radio series about space exploration. They joined me online a couple of days ago. Brenda and Kirby, welcome to Planetary Radio. I am so glad that you are here to talk to us, not just about this concept study that you helped to lead, but about this whole process, which is going to reach sort of a climax in just a few days as people are hearing this. Welcome, first of all.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here, Matt.
Thanks for having us.
So I was hoping that the Planetary Science and Astrobiology Decadal Survey covering the next 10 years of NASA work in space would be released before our conversation. But we learned last week that it's not going to become public until I think the date is April 19th. There are a lot of hopes and maybe even careers riding on this big influential release, aren't there?
Yes, I believe that's true.
Yeah.
What is a planetary decadal mission concept study, which is what you have submitted with this concept called Neptune Odyssey?
The decadal studies come out roughly every 10 years. They're not quite perfectly on the decadal. And what they are is they're a place where NASA reaches out to the community to find out what the community thinks is important for planetary studies, astrobiology studies going forward, to give NASA guidance on where it should invest its money and plan for the future to get the best science return.
And we have talked about decadal studies. I mean, we just had the astrophysics decadal
released not too many weeks ago. These really are, I mean, I use the word influential. That's right, isn't it, Kirby?
Yeah, these are absolutely influential. I mean, I think Casey Dreyer has probably been on, you know, on the space policy version of this podcast talking about how it's sort of the guidebook or maybe like the Bible for NASA for the next 10 years. Not that NASA is legally obligated to follow it, but it is certainly the decadal surveys really get the will of the people in the community and are very influential at the level of the National Academies of Sciences and also very influential in Congress. And so these really have a very strong effect in guiding what kinds of missions get flown, what kinds of research get funded, really at the top level, and then how that trickles down into individual research grants, individual groups of scientists might want to lead. And it's a very influential document, really guiding exploration of the solar system for the next 10 years.
I read that there were 11 concept studies selected for development. This was back in 2019. So this is not something you've just spent a few weeks working on, since your project is one of these. Yeah, I found 9 of the resulting papers in the Planetary Science Journal, and we will put up a link to that because they're all open access. People can take a look at them. We'll put that in this week's on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. Quite a variety there. 2 each for Ceres and Mars, a Pluto orbiter, a Mercury lander, a lunar geophysical network, the Orbilander concept, which is an orbiter and a lander for Enceladus, which is something that's been mentioned in at least one previous episode of our show. And then there's this study that you two are part of, Neptune Odyssey. How did this get started? When did you become involved in it? Brenda, I'll go to you first.
Well, whenever NASA does the decadals, they try to pair concepts with what they call design labs. APL is one of their design labs that they use. So they reached out to us. We actually did more than just the Neptune Odyssey. We had 2 other decadal studies that we worked on at the same time. Hmm. And then we put together a team of scientists and engineers to go through and develop a sort of what we call a point design that allows us to prove that a mission is possible and that it reasonably closes to achieve the science that the community is interested in.
Kirby, how did you get involved?
Back in 2018 or 2019, NASA put out a solicitation for proposals to propose to do a mission concept study. And the PI, the principal investigator for this report, Dr. Abby Reimer, put in a proposal with quite a number of us on the team, not just at APL, but really around the country from different institutions. And fortunately, our concept study was selected for funding from NASA to look into what it would take to send an orbiter to the Neptune system. I have a background working on New Horizons during the Pluto and Arrokoth flybys, and I worked very closely with Abby, becoming the project scientist, kind of this interface a little bit between the science and the engineering teams, working with Abby and Brenda on this project. And so, you know, we were selected end of 2019, going into 2020, and we started doing things in person. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And so the vast majority of the study got done from our bedrooms and dens with pets roaming around.
Such is life, right, in this part of the 21st century. And by the way, Abby, who was unable to join us today, I'm told that she's still putting in some time at NASA headquarters right now. Yep. We, you know, send our regards to her, and she was thrilled to know that the two of you would be joining us on the show today. We've heard from so many guests who want to see a mission to one or both of our solar neighborhoods, ice giants. And that's exactly, of course, what is written about here in this study. It bears repeating. Why is it so important that we return to one or both of these worlds, Uranus and Neptune, that have only been visited really once ever by spacecraft? And that was, of course, by Voyager.
Yeah, that's right. And you kind of hit the nail on the head right there, Matt. It's because we've only visited each of these planets, Uranus and Neptune, once, and it was just with a flyby. And Voyager 2 is for its time, especially, is a very capable spacecraft, and the science we got at Uranus and Neptune is revolutionary. But the science you can get with just a quick flyby is not certainly not the level you can get if you hang out in the neighborhood for a long time and do multiple orbits and image things from different perspectives and fly through different parts of the magnetic field and maybe even observe some small seasonal changes while you spend time looking for changes on the surfaces of Triton or the moons or in the atmosphere or changes in the rings. You know, that would be exciting to see as well. We've had an orbiter at a dwarf planet at Ceres. That's already happened. And so really the ice giants are the last category of planet that has never had an orbiter. Our exploration of the solar system is far from complete until we are able to kind of get the type of data that you can only get from an orbiter mission. And I'll also add that many, many of the exoplanets that we're discovering around other stars tend to be in this Uranus to Neptune mass regime. By understanding ice giant planets in our own solar system, we can use them as analogs or analogous to the similarly massed exoplanets around other stars, and then really have a better, more broad general understanding of planets in general. Understanding planetary systems, not just as they are in our own solar system, but understanding planets in general around the galaxy and cosmos.
That's such an important point, and one that has been made several times on Planetary Radio. You already indicated that this is much broader than studying the planet itself. We've got those thin rings that are worthy of exploration, a whole bunch of moons, but one in particular that you haven't mentioned yet, Triton, right?
That's right. Triton is one of my favorite places in the solar system. It is a captured dwarf planet from the Kuiper Belt. It is the only large moon in the solar system that orbits its primary planet backwards with regards to the primary planet's rotation direction. That, combined with its eccentric orbit, is a dead ringer that it did not form with Neptune, that it was captured into orbit at some point in the solar system's past. It, in some ways, is like a big sister to Pluto. It's twice as massive, but it's just a little bit larger. It's roughly the same distance from the sun as Pluto, about 30 astronomical units or about 3 billion miles, 5 billion kilometers. We think its surface composition is the same. Voyager did not have an imaging spectrometer on board, so we don't have as good of compositional information on the surface of Triton that we do from New Horizons at Pluto. But from Earth-based spectroscopy, you know, we've got nitrogen, methane, carbon monoxide, water on the surface of Triton. And the way the geology manifests on Triton, even though it's at the same distance from the sun, roughly, as Pluto, and we think made out of the same things, the way the geology manifests is very different from Pluto. And it's its own exotic little planet orbiting a giant planet that's worthy of study. And as a planetary geologist personally, who uses images of other planetary surfaces to do his science, I'm really excited just thinking about further exploration of Triton.
I was so pleased when I saw the website for this study, Neptune Odyssey. And first of all, it's a beautiful website and you have a terrific animation. And again, we'll put a link to that on this week's show page, planetary.org/radio.
I want to give a call out to Mike Yakovlev, who made that beautiful animation. Mike Yakovlev in our comms department at APL.
Good. Kudos there. Well, well deserved. It really is beautiful. One of the things that I love seeing, though, really warmed my heart, because Margaret Kivelson, the pioneering astrophysicist, was our guest on the show just 2 weeks before this. And when I saw that long boom with a magnetometer out there, I knew Margaret would have to be pleased when she saw this this study. You really are in very good company. I mean, you talked about the team that's been put together. It's kind of a who's who of planetary science. And to a large degree, these other fields that you've talked about with the two of you and Abby up there leading the way, I suppose. But it must be a point of pride to have so many terrific people, many of whom have been guests on this show.
It's certainly humbling to be around so many smart and accomplished people. And you mentioned Margaret and that magnetometer boom. One of the reasons we want to fly that is not just to study the magnetic field around Neptune, but also to study the induced or any intrinsic magnetic field around Triton. Because we have a lot of reason to believe that Triton is an ocean world with a subterranean liquid water ocean that is probably habitable. That's not the same thing as being inhabited, but I believe that Margaret was instrumental in discovering that induced field around Europa, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, absolutely.
This is where the astrobiology and the habitability comes in, of understanding Triton as a potentially habitable ocean world. And indeed, not just Triton, but Triton as somewhat of an analog for other Kuiper Belt dwarf planets, the most common type of planet in the solar system. A lot of these small little planets probably could have started off being at least somewhat habitable in the first half billion to billion years of the solar system's history. And so understanding this interaction between ice, water, and rock 3+ billion miles from the sun is really important and really exciting. You mentioned the orbital insertion and delivering the probe, and that's a really exciting time / terrifying time in the mission concept, because after a 16-year-long cruise from Earth to Neptune, you know, we don't even need gravity assist along the way. We can go straight there. All of a sudden, you have to thread this needle, as I recall, between the rings and the planet, drop off the probe. The probe has to enter the atmosphere, take its measurements, broadcast back to the orbiter before the orbiter has even burned its engine to slow down to go into orbit. The orbiter has to receive the radio signal from the probe before the probe gets destroyed, stored on board. The probe then gets down to a certain altitude where the orbiter has gone below the horizon and also then gets crushed by Neptune's atmosphere. And then the orbiter has to burn its engine, go into a very long capture orbit that's many months long, and then broadcast the information back to Earth. And then we use Triton to shape the whole orbital tour around Neptune in a very similar way, at least, you know, on paper, to how Cassini used Titan's gravity to shape its orbit around Saturn. So it is a very complicated, not just orbital dance, but getting all the spacecraft systems to work at the right time while we're collecting science.
You still want to take this on after all that, Brenda?
Of course. I love a good challenge.
Of course. And when you talk about a direct route, what are we talking about as a vehicle? What are you proposing if there's a mission like this that is actually funded someday? Are we talking Falcon Heavy or
We've got two choices. You could do an SLS Block 2 or you could do a Falcon Heavy.
Of course, we're getting ahead of ourselves here. We got to get through this decadal release, first of all. And every one of the proposals that I mentioned, the nine that I was able to find, every one of these deserves its time in the sun, shall we say. Let's say that we come out, it comes out on April 19th, and it does say that up near the top, or maybe the top priority, is a mission that could look like Neptune Odyssey. Then what? What comes next? Will APL pursue this?
APL may very well pursue it. One of the things that we've learned over the years with the decadals too is something that's proposed in the decadal often will morph and become other types of missions. What you may see is a scaled back version of this that gets put in as New Frontiers or a Discovery class mission. There are a lot of options for where this might end up going. You may also see this stretched out and not done as part of this decadal, but maybe started under this decadal and then continued under the next. There, it's really up for NASA to decide at what level they would want to do a mission like this, and then as well how they might approach it or even combine it with other opportunities.
Kirby, if you want to be in planetary science, it really helps to be able to play the long game, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of an impatient person by nature, and ironically, I chose a career path that forces patience. That's the only way to do it. I'm dying to see what the other hemisphere of Triton looks like that Voyager never got to image. I'd love to know more. I'd love some other pictures of Neptune than just what Voyager got back in 1989. I really want to explore the planets and see what's out there, and this is the only way to do it.
Folks, I wish you great luck, at least in terms of the influence that this study may have on the decadal. I would wish the same to any of those other teams. But, you know, as I've said many times, we have talked to a lot of people on this show who want to see a mission to the ice giants. And, you know, I'm one of those. So thank you so much for taking us through this study. Kirby, I got to ask you one more question, and it's loaded. When did you first become affiliated with this show, or at least at the listener level?
I think I go back close to the beginning of the show. I was in high school or early college. Were you guys doing this in 2003, 2004?
We had just started. We got our start in late 2002, and that's when I think I started hearing from you.
Yeah, that's around the same time. So I've been listening to this show all that time. It's quite an honor to be on here, Matt. And I remember when you and I got to meet for the first time, I was a little bit of a fanboy, to be honest.
Now, here I was fishing for just a selfish little compliment, and you delivered so much with that little speech there. Thank you so much, Kirby. And I am just delighted that We have been crossing paths for so many years, and now I'm the fanboy for people like the two of you and your team and everybody out there who is doing the work that we dedicate this show to. Brenda, not required to have been a 20-year listener to Planetary Radio, but again, delightful talking to you as well, and thanks for all your great work.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Brenda Clyde is part of the principal professional staff at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory and project engineer for the Neptune Odyssey concept study. Her APL colleague, Kirby Runyon, is a senior research scientist in planetary geology and project scientist for the study. Bruce Betts and What's Up in 1 minute here on Planetary Radio.
Greetings all, Bill Nye here. Missions of discovery are underway right now thanks to the Planetary Society, the world's largest independent space advocacy organization. The fight for space science and exploration never ends. You can help us make sure our representatives understand how important this work is. There are several ways to get involved. We've got all the information you need at planetary.org/takeaction. That's planetary.org/takeaction. Thank you.
There's so much going on in the world of space science and exploration, and we're here to share it with you. Hi, I'm Sarah, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Are you looking for a place to get more space? Catch the latest space exploration news, pretty planetary pictures, and Planetary Society publications on our social media channels. You can find the Planetary Society on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. Make sure you like and subscribe so you never miss the next exciting update from the world of planetary science.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. The chief scientist of the Planetary Society is here with us. That is Dr. Bruce Betts. Welcome. We have, from Keith Landa, he looked it up, Gilligan's Island episode, season 2, episode 4, Smile. You're on Mars, Cameron. Tells you what happened in the episode. I'd forgotten some of the details, like the professor tried to make a glue out of tree sap to glue the lens for the probe back together. Hilarity ensues.
It's truly one of the most realistic depictions of a space probe that's ever been committed to the small screen or the large screen. We talked about that last week, by the way, for those who might be wondering why we started with Gilligan's Island.
How dare you miss our discussion of the Gilligan's Island last week?
How dare you
week?
Not well, remember I'm it? I'm sure no one missed it.
I am glad you're here for our discussion this week, beginning with what's up in the night sky.
All right, there in the pre-dawn sky, you got those three planets hanging out low in the east. You got super bright Venus, and then to its upper right, you'll see reddish Mars and yellowish Saturn, which is now passing Mars and heading farther to the upper right. Mars varies a lot in brightness, but right now it's about the same brightness as Saturn. Of course, Venus is just ridiculously bright, and it's kind of obnoxious, but that's another story. Oh, I wanted to mention one other thing, this solar activity. I don't mention the sun very often because I always have to then say, hey, don't look at the sun or you'll fry your eyes out. Don't look at the sun with just sunglasses or anything other than appropriate solar filters. But if you look at the sun with a telescope these days, with an appropriate solar filter, you will be seeing sunspots more and more as we go deeper into this new solar cycle. We move on to this week in space history. It was this week in 1961 that Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space. 1970, Apollo 13 was launched. They came back. They were safe. 2001, Matt, Mars Odyssey launched. Mars Odyssey is still working. Odyssey around Mars. Let us go on to random space. Random space fact.
19 and a half years. Don't start forgetting now.
This is a simple one, but I think it's good to be reminded occasionally, especially as we find more of these things, that the solar system's planets, just the planets, not counting asteroids or dwarf planets, just the planets have more than 200 moons. Mm. 207 and counting, depending on details of what you consider a moon.
Hardly seems fair that we only have one. But then, you know, there's Venus to make us feel better.
Venus. You got no moon. And we got the coolest moon. It's the moon. We go on to the trivia contest. The question I asked you as opposed to the question I meant to ask you, was what was the first ESA, European Space Agency, mission to use ion propulsion? A valid and intriguing question of which we got great answers, and I learned things from our listeners.
Well, there was a cavalcade of errors here. I made an error when I listed the question on the entry page at planetary.org. All I said was, what was the first European Space Agency to use ion or electric propulsion? Well, it was the European Space Agency, as Bruce pointed out a few minutes ago. It turns out, I mean, what answer were you looking for?
What I meant to say was beyond the Earth, and I was thinking it was Smart One. And anyway, what I asked was the first ESA mission to use ion propulsion. And hey, I learned stuff. Thank you, listeners.
Devin O'Rourke, he's a longtime listener, first-time winner, as far as I could tell. Devin is in Colorado. He said Eureka.
Eureka!
E-U-R-E-C-A, which is short for European Retrievable Carrier. I brought this up with Bruce, and you looked it up, and looks like this is correct, right?
It does seem to be correct. It actually beat the other entries that you may discuss by many years. And 1992 was the launch, 93. Fascinating mission.
There are a whole bunch of experiments were loaded onto this sort of bus, and it was delivered by a space shuttle and then brought back down to Earth, right?
By a different space shuttle after being exposed to the space environment for over a year. And then they saw what happened. They had a lot of experiments on board. It was huge, as you say. A bus is used in the technical term, but it was about the mass of a bus, 5,000 kilograms. So 1,000 times more massive than our Lightsail 2 spacecraft. A random space fact of interest.
I was going to say, a nice little extra random space fact bonus there. Devin, congratulations. You not only got it right, you taught us something. And for your trouble, we're going to send you that Planetary Society Your Place in Space t-shirt from Chop Shop. Then you can take a look at it and all the other great Planetary Society merch at chopshopstore.com. Thank you, everybody, for providing these great answers for us. We're going to give you another opportunity right now.
Back to moons of planets. If you alphabetize the named moons of planets in our solar system, what moon is last? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. Oh, and it's the English alphabet we're using.
Ah, good point. You have until April 13, that would be 8 a.m. on Wednesday, April 13, to get us this answer. And here is that Chop Shop prize package. It is the Planetary Society's very own Kick Asteroid. It's a whole set of stuff. An 18 by 24 screen print, a pin, and four Kick Asteroid stickers. As far as I'm concerned, it'd be worth it for the beautiful poster alone that is about a $45 value. It's just marvelous. So get out there and kick some asteroid with us, and we wish you good luck.
That's a really cool package. I love those things. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about the next bird you tweet. What is it saying to you? Thank you, and good night.
Is that you?
Yes. It's a hidden talent.
That's Bruce, who's actually tweeting at us right there. If you want to catch his tweets elsewhere, it's at Random Space Fact, right?
Yes, it is.
Just like I'm at PlanRad, although I don't tweet nearly as often or well as the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its ice giant loving members. Mark Hilverda and Ray Paletta are our associate producers. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.